having the opportunity to do this means a lot to me. I wanted to lead tonight as soon as I heard who was speaking. I've known our speaker for 19 years. She has shared in my grief and in my celebrations. While our program is built upon the steps, traditions, and concepts, the friendships that we make in the program are really the icing on the cake. And throughout the years, our speaker has been an inspiration to me and many, many others. So it is my great privilege to introduce Helen C. from South Pasadena.
That. I don't even have a tissue. Oh. Okay, you guys, so now I'm all teary. Hi, I'm Helen.
Hi.
That's my favorite part. I'm all satisfied. I can sit down now. They say in our opening that you may not like all of us, but you'll love us in a very, very special way. So I'm going to pretend that you guys all love me. Because right now I'm pretty much of a nervous wreck. God, this is like talking in front of a convention. The first time I came to this meeting, it was still pretty small, and I always remember the feeling I got here was, God, I knew all the guys here, and I wonder where they all went. They used to come to my meetings, and I thought they just left the program, and they were all here, so that was kind of fun. I want to say thank you to David for, for inviting me to speak here. I'm not sure about that yet. No, seriously, it's always an honor for me when someone says, will you come and speak at my meeting? I'm not a circuit speaker by any means. And I mean, I've had the pleasure of speaking many times, but certainly not the circuit type speaker. So you're not going to hear, if you heard me speak before, you're probably not going to hear any of the same things, because I didn't get to Al-Anon until I was 45, so I got 45 years of stories. So if you hear nothing you heard before, I'm not making it up. They taught me when I came to Al-Anon, and I share in a meeting, to always consider the newcomers. So hopefully I will, as I go along, remember not to just talk Al-Anon lingo and help newcomers to understand what our program is about. And I was also taught that I'm supposed to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'd like to just go to what it's like now, but I'll tell a little bit about what it was like. I grew up in a family of drunks. There was one alcoholic out of those drunks, and I can say that because my sister went to AA and found sobriety. And unbeknownst to me, she lived in Illinois, I live in California. She was going to AA, finding her sobriety at the same time I was starting Al-Anon, and neither of us knew that. So when we were having a conversation one day, she goes, are you going to some kind of meetings or something? And I go, yeah, how'd you know? And she goes, I think maybe either we're going to the same meetings or we're going to similar meetings. What are you going to? And I said, well, I'm going to Al-Anon. What are you going to? And she said, AA. And I go, wow. So that one got sober. And the others just were drunks. And they were my brothers and sisters. My mom and dad didn't seem to have... my dad could have had maybe our part of the family disease, but he died when I was only 8, so I'm not certain about. I kind of think from what I'd heard from the family, he had a little control issues. Not much, a little. Like me, just a little. And my mom was a social drinker, so it was amazing how there were 5 of us, and out of the 5, I'm the only one that wasn't affected by alcoholism, and the rest of them all were. They were in varying degrees critical, punishing, judgmental, and it was very difficult. It was a difficult life growing up with them. They were my caretakers, because when Dad died, Mom went to work. So that's who took care of me. And when I first came to Al-Anon, my daughter went with me to an adult child meeting and identified with that. And I thought, well, why do I, my parents didn't drink. So it took me a few meetings to find out why I identified. But it was really good to know, because then I understood more why I felt the way I felt, even though my parents didn't drink. It was my brothers and sisters, they were my caretakers, and they affected me dramatically. In that, you know, I came away from that experience with absolutely no self-esteem, because I was always told that I was weird. Well, of course I was weird. I didn't drink like they drank. And I didn't think like they thought. And so, of course, I was weird. I was considered very weird, and I was told that, and odd, and, you know, what's the matter with you? And I was told I couldn't do that because I was too little, or, you know, I didn't have. And they liked to argue. Oh my God, they liked to argue. Every time I would take somebody home with me, they'd say, "God, your brothers and sisters hate each other." I'd go, "Oh no. Oh no, they're best friends." And they go, "They don't act much like that." And I go, "I know, me either. I don't get it either." In fact, it used to disturb me a lot. I spent a lot of my childhood hiding in the closet because of all their arguments. But you see, they were drinking. So by the time the arguments were over, everybody was fine. And then I was all messed up, and they want to know the next day, "What's wrong with you anyway? Oh God, don't you know you guys had a knockdown drag out last night?" They go, "We did. We thought we were just having a good time." I go, "Yeah, okay." So it was very, very confusing to me. I didn't understand that. Took me to get to Al-Anon to understand a lot of that behavior. Anyway, when I was 19, I decided to do my first geographic, and I was living in Illinois, and decided it was time for me to come to California. Now, did I know anybody here? Did I have a job? Have a place to live? No. No to all of that. I did not. And I don't know where I got that courage, except, you know, because I didn't have any courage. I was full of fears. I never took any risks. But yet I got on an airplane and came to California with no place to go, and no prospects for a place to go. So I wound up going and looking for a job. I actually was staying at the Y and looking for a job. And lo and behold, I found a job quickly. And I, you know, in this era, it would be unheard of to find a job in a few days, but I did. Found a job in a few days and went to work in an office. And I told them a little story about my low self-esteem. I told them that I could do a little typing, and I could do a little filing, and I could do a little shorthand. That's what I told them my abilities were. Well, to tell you the truth, when I had left Illinois, I had left a job in a state of Illinois hospital where I was assistant medical records department head. I didn't tell them that. I didn't write that on my... I guess I didn't want people to expect anything of me. So if I would have told you that, then you would have expected me, and I didn't want you expecting anything of me. So I went to work in an office where I did a little typing, and it wasn't long before... are there any children here? I'm not going to say that. I was... I forgot I'm being recorded. I was involved with the boss. Let's put it that way. Now, he was very cute. You know, I didn't have too many values before I came to Al-Anon. So when I was looking for a man, I needed two things that were really important. They had to be really cute, and they had to be fun. And beyond that, I didn't care. I didn't know. What did I know? That's all. Remember, I grew up in alcoholism, where it was always fun and everybody was cute. So that's all I knew. So he fit that criteria. He was fun and he was cute. And first thing you know, he asked me to go for a drink with him somewhere, and I told him fine. And now there was a problem there. He was married. But you see, I didn't have any values. And I didn't have any intentions, you know, to... I'm going to have a drink, that's all. I didn't mean to get involved with him. Well, that did not happen. He was way too fun and way too cute, and I did get involved with him. So, you know, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. You know, it turned out we had to go get a quickie Mexican divorce. I got to tell the truth. We went to Mexico to get a divorce and to get married, but we didn't do that. And I always remember a friend of mine, because I used to say, we went to Mexico, we got to get a quickie divorce. And I never told her we didn't do that. And then one day I was talking about that I actually got married in Las Vegas. She goes, "You always said you went to Mexico to get." I said, "We went to get it. I most of the time did not tell you the whole story. I told you the part that looked good, and then you had to guess the rest of it. and if you guessed wrong, that wasn't my problem, you know. So I just told her, it's not my problem you guessed wrong. You should have asked me. But anyway, I'm a little more honest than I used to be, and I try not to exaggerate on things, but we eventually did go to Las Vegas and get married there. And I was also very pregnant by that time, and with my first daughter. We at first traveled a lot, especially, and then I had a second daughter also, and we traveled a lot while the kids were young. He loved to get in the car and go. We also lived all over the country. So my life was pretty exciting. He was always successful. He was a salesman, and whatever he got into, he did a good job at it. Because he was fun and cute, great salesman, and he was always top of the line. And he took really good care of us. He also had a few other problems. One of them was he was a womanizer, so I spent quite a lot of time at home while he was out womanizing. Now, I knew that's who he was when I married him, because after all, he got involved with me, right? So I knew that about him. But you see, I thought I was different, and I thought I just loved him enough, you know, that he wouldn't do that anymore. Well, I know now that the alcoholism and the drinking and the drunkenness went hand in hand with the, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody in the bar looks good, and whatever all that was. I know they went together now, but I didn't know that then. So I was pretty unhappy in my marriage, because that was from the get-go he did that. Finally, he got too old and quit it, but it wasn't because he didn't want to. I mean, he just couldn't anymore. But anyway. So our marriage was a lot about him. And why he came home, I have no idea. A lot about him coming home drunk and me with my mouth attached to the doorknob. And as soon as he walked in, I'd start screaming at him and beating on his chest and yelling at him. And I don't know why he came home. Why did he ever come home? I couldn't figure that out. I think he needed some place to pass out. That's all I can think. Why would you come home to that? Every time, never and never failing. I never opened the door and said, oh, hi, honey. Welcome home, or how are you doing? Nothing. I always yelled at him. Now, when I met him, he was very happy-go-lucky, nice guy, having a good time, pretty good life, and oh my God, I took care of that pretty quick. He no longer had a happy life, and he no longer was happy-go-lucky, and we were just, you know, that's the way we existed. I think what I thought was... somehow or another, even though I told you about how I met him and what happened, and somehow I thought I was being a good Catholic girl. Hello? And I was taught if you married a guy, you stayed with him, right? Make your bed, you lie in it. And I did that, even though I knew from the beginning it wasn't working and it was not going to work. So I can remember, oh gosh, I know our second child was born, so maybe after about 4 or 5 years thinking, you know, I need to get a job. And I need to just take these kids and I need to get out, because this is not a good environment for them with us fighting all the time. And him being out all night, and I knew that wasn't good for them. So I did. I went and got a job. Let's see. 20 years later, I left. Oh, I told you I was full of fear. I just didn't know how to be by myself. I didn't know how to leave him. And by the way, even though he behaved in all that manner, there were still a lot of things about him I loved. He was a lot of fun. We did a lot of fun things together. We traveled together. We did have a good... We drank together, by the way. And so it wasn't a matter of, you know, he was this horrid person all the time. He wasn't. And so it was hard to leave that. Plus, I had the 2 children. But eventually, you know, it came to the point where I needed to go. I remember that he started getting sicker and sicker. He was the kind of guy that got up every morning, put on his suit and tie, sometimes a 3-piece suit and a tie, looked like $1 million, went off to work, even though he was dreadfully hungover. And he did that, and he brought the money home, and he took care of us. I don't know quite how he did that, but it came a point where he couldn't do that anymore, because that's what happens in our disease. I mean, the alcoholic's disease, they get, me too, get sicker and sicker, and he couldn't function any longer, and wound up falling down drunk. And I was always worried, because he smoked, that he would burn the house down. And I was smart enough to know that if that was going to happen, I better get the insurance raised. So I did. Went out and raised up our insurance. And I was correct. Within a very short time, he did burn up the place. We lost everything. Now, you'd think that would be enough for me to say, you know, goodbye. Even that wasn't enough. I had to stay longer even after that. Finally, I came home from work one day, and now we're in a new apartment, you know, new furniture, new clothes, everything's new because we lost everything. And he was laying on the floor in a heap. Now, there was lots of times I was always thinking, if he'd just run off the road on the way home, then I wouldn't have to worry about him anymore. Just run off the road. Now, I never had any homicidal thoughts or suicidal thoughts. However, I heard somebody say that, you know, when you're an alcoholic family, everybody has a side, homicide or suicide. So my thoughts were more like, just make it clean, because I was pretty much of a neat freak. Let him run off the road. So I came home and found him in a heap on the floor, and because I was really sweet, I was a really sweet woman, and I spoke very sweet, I walked over and I kicked him. And damn, he groaned, and I thought he was gone. I thought my wish was fulfilled. I thought he was gone. So when I speak, I talk about having these two ideas in my head at the same time. It's like, oh my God, he's dead, and oh God, he's dead, you know. So it's like, how can you have those at the same time? But I did. But no, he was not dead. But however, he was very, very ill, and he had to be taken to the old St. Luke's Hospital in Pasadena, Altadena. And they told me that, they said to me in a very, sorrowful look, gee, Mrs. Calloway, your husband may not make it through the drying out period. And I had to go very sadly, oh, that's so sad. All the time thinking, great. Oh my God. I was a little crazy. So, but he did make it through it. And then from there, he went into the St. Luke's in-house alcohol program, in which they told me that I needed help. And I corrected them. And I told them, no, you're wrong. I am fine. Fine. Do you all guys know what that is? Fine. If you don't, ask somebody. I'm not going to say it, because I'm being recorded. Because I'm not going to say it. Told them that I was fine. And they said, well, if you will not come to the meetings, then he will not get any aftercare. Well, I knew he needed aftercare. So I said, okay, I would go to the meeting. So they told me there was meetings for him over here, and over here there were meetings for me. And so that's how I got to my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, granted, it was a program, and so there was other people in the program going to the meeting. So we were like little soldiers, you know, a bunch of us. We'd go into the Al-Anon meeting, and when the meeting was over, it was like, didn't talk to anybody, didn't read anything, didn't share anything, just, and they told me I only go to three. We're a lot harder on newcomers now. I have to come to six now. So if you're new and this is your first meeting, try us six times before you decide. So anyway, that was my first Al-Anon meeting, and I didn't like it. I thought everybody was, like I'd been called all my life, very weird, and they had all these problems. See, I didn't have any problems. The only problem I had was this guy that was now in the hospital getting, now I had no problems. Life was going to be perfect. And so then on the third meeting, they invited someone to speak, like what I'm doing tonight. And as God would have it, she told my story. And I will never forget sitting there listening to her, thinking to myself, how does she know all that stuff? Nobody in my life knows that stuff. How does she know that stuff? And she was a great speaker, and she did speak at conventions, and she traveled all over. And every time I would see her, I would tell her the same thing, that she saved my life. And she goes, no, dear, no, I didn't save your life. You were just in the right place so that you could hear the right things, so you could keep coming. And I did. That was 29 years ago, and I'm still coming back. Al-Anon, at first, was very difficult for me. I couldn't be honest enough to work the program. I couldn't bring myself to ask anyone to sponsor me. I was definitely a perfectionist, and I could prove it to you because I sat in meetings like this all the time. The Al-Anon rub. I I don't know if you guys have ever had that or not, but what that is carrying a really heavy load, trying to appear perfect, and you have to dance a lot because you have to think on your feet all the time to stay perfect. And then if you don't tell the truth, then you have to work really hard to remember what the heck you did say. So it's a hard bro to hoe, but that's what I was when I got here. So it made it difficult for me to work the program. So because I wasn't working any program, I mean, I was sitting in chairs and I was absorbing. What happened to me more than twice, was I kept getting 13-stepped. And that was bad. That was really hard. That was hard on me. It almost made me want to leave the program a couple of times. But, you know, again, higher power was there for me. He was with me, and he kept me coming back. And in the beginning, I couldn't figure out why I was coming back. But now I know. It was because you loved me. And you loved me in a special way that I'd never been loved before. And maybe you didn't like me, but you loved me. And I felt that. But I couldn't have told you in the beginning what I felt. There was no way for me to know what I felt in the beginning. I didn't feel anything. I came in sort of numb. I remember making a decision that I was going to stay with my husband, my husband as I call him. But in order to stay with him, I was going to have to shut down my feelings. I remember making that decision. So I just shut down all my feelings and stayed. So I had to, you know, be in the program for a little bit before I could start recognizing any feelings. The first feeling that I recognized was fear. I was afraid to do anything. If I didn't know how to do it, I wouldn't let you know that I didn't know how to do it. I just wouldn't do it. But I wouldn't say to you, could you show me or would you teach me? Because, oh, what if I made a mistake? And then what would you think of me? Then you'd call me weird, or you'd call me strange, or you'd call me stupid, because that's what everybody called me. So that's why I like it when you call me Helen. Because nobody did that. They all had these other names for me. So that was the first feeling that I felt when I got into Allen was fear. When I was finally able to overcome that fear and start working the program, you know, that's when I started to grow. I never truly asked anyone to sponsor me. I used people. I made friends and I used those friends as sponsors, but I never truly said to anyone, would you sponsor me? For at least somewhere between my second and my third year. Then I finally, I'm telling you, I thought I was going to faint. I was so scared when I asked that woman, because I knew she was going to go, are you kidding me? As crazy as you are, no way. But instead she said, okay. It's like, oh, she said, okay. So then I got to be able to start growing. When I was new, I know I hadn't asked anybody to sponsor me, and I know I wasn't working any steps. I wasn't doing much of anything. But we used to have this thing in the program when I was new. It was called Get in the Car. That's what they'd say to you. Get in the car, we're going here. Get in the car, we're going there. They did that all the time. And they were, I mean, you know, I think everybody kind of knew that when they looked at me, this was a sick one. Let's go get her and put her in the car. And so they did. And they put me in the car and they took me to intergroup. And I liked it. I liked it there. And so my first little position above my group was, assistant something intergroup rep. I wasn't the intergroup rep, I was just going to help her out. And she said to me that her job was to go to these meetings. They were in, I don't even remember where they were then, a long time ago. That she was going to these meetings, and she went every other month. And I go, so you have 6 meetings to go to? And she goes, yes. And I said, you can't make 6 meetings? And she said, well, maybe I could use some help. And I go, fine. So I got in the car and went with her. I did like it. I stayed in intergroup for a number of years after that. I got voted in as group rep. And then I got voted on the service board, and that was fun. I really liked that. So if you're looking for a job that's not too hard, but yet you'd like to go something beyond the group, intergroup is fun. Service was really important to me. I didn't know it. I didn't know how much that was going to help me grow. I had no idea, but it did. And in all the time that I was in service, you know, it makes all your defects of character pop up. And I think that's probably why eventually I had to ask somebody to sponsor me, because all these defects were popping up that I didn't know what to do with, and I didn't know how to handle them, and I didn't know. And I had a lot of them, a lot of them. I did eventually start working the steps, and because I was so perfect, it was really, really difficult for me to do 1, 2, and 3, because in there you sort of have to surrender, and that was hard. But when I finally got the understanding of that, surrender did not mean that I was being weak. Surrender just said to me, there's something else. It's not just you by yourself anymore. There's help for you. That's what I always tell people. Step one is really difficult, but hold on. There's help in step two. So, and then, you know, and by having the courage to work the first three steps, finally, then I got to step four and I got stuck again. Again, the fear and again the perfection and again the, you know, if you really knew me, what would you think? So I got invited to go to a weekend retreat, and they were doing the fourth step there. And so they broke us off into groups, and they told us, you know, sit down at this table, and we're going to write, and you're going to have a leader at the table. And I said, oh, excuse me, but I have to go to the bathroom. And they said, no, you don't. Just sit down here. I said, I really need something to drink. And they said, we'll get it for you. So they lassoed me and sat me down at the table and made me write, and I started writing my fourth step there. I probably would have never done it without that. And I had a very loving woman that was the leader of our table, and that was the woman I asked to sponsor me, and she was heavily into service. And so she started taking me again, getting the car business, and all over with her. Took me all over with her. And I got, you know, I got introduced to a lot of things that otherwise I would not have. She encouraged me to volunteer to be group rep. And so I did that. And again, I liked it. Some people don't like that stuff. I mean, I've taken people to World Service with me as group rep, and they run out of there screaming and going, oh my God, what just happened there? That was terrible. Because if there's an opinion, I mean, if there's a some discussion on the floor, you can stand up in front of the microphone and have an opinion. Well, 20 Al-Anons will lead up because they never had an opinion before. And now they get to stand in front of 300 people and have an opinion. They love it. So people go home and go, oh, my God, that was horrible. But I liked it. I liked it. So it turned out that alternate, that's the word I was looking for. I got to be alternate group rep, and then I graduated in a group rep. And then I got voted, because nobody wants to do this stuff. So if you're willing, you know, they say, oh, yes, oh, yay. Oh, God. And then what's the next thing after group rep? District rep. And that was fun. And, you know, and how God works it out, district rep can be a full-time job. Huh? Those of you that have done it, it can be a full-time job. And one of the things that you get to do is you get to go around all the meetings in your area. And I got fired from my job, so so it was cool. It worked out really great. I had all this time on my hands that I could have been miserable and commiserating and, oh, my God, I lost my job. Instead, I got to have all the free time to go and do the district rep work, so it was very fun. So Al-Anon is always, the service in Al-Anon has always been the best for me. You know, our program is a triangle. Like, you can't see this, but I've got a triangle around my neck. And that other part of the triangle is service. And I know I've had people say to me, especially, not so much now because I'm old, but when I was younger, where'd you get all that wisdom? And I said, you know, I got it from service. And I was hanging out with winners, and that's how you get it. And yeah, was I scared? I didn't want to be district rep because I thought that, again, you were going to expect all these things out of me. And then I found out, no, I don't expect anything out of you. They're just grateful that you're doing it, so they don't have to do it. No. and the other area of my life that that I got to be of service in was the convention that David announced, AFG, coming up. And I remember going to my first AFG little planning committee, and there was this row, there was a table up in front. And there was, like, you know, a bunch of women up there. And so I told the person that brought me, so who are they? And the person said, well, they're members of Al-Anon. I go, yeah. It's like, she liked the president? No. guess where I wound up. So I loved convention work, and I did work my way up through the chairs, and then actually ran to be AFG chairman, and by some miracle or God, you know, I got to be AFG chairman, which was wonderful. It was wonderful. It's a big commitment, because it's not you just get to be chairman and get to start telling people what to do. Your first year, you're the gopher, and you get to do all the dirty work the first year. Then they finally let you be chairman the second year, and then they don't tell you when you run for that position and you get it. They don't tell you that on your third year, you're site and housing chairman. That means you have to run the whole show with the hotel and the food and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's like, if they told you that, you'd never run. So they don't tell you that. But again, you know, all of that, all of those, I mean, I had never dealt with a hotel with a convention for, you know, 1,000 people. I'd never done that. But you know what? I did it. I didn't do it alone. I did it with a supportive committee. But it sure brought up a lot of things in me, again, that I needed to look at and I needed to work on. And the planning of it was just a ball. We had a great time. We had a wonderful time. I had the committee always selects what, you know, what they want the theme to be, but I had my own theme. In front of the little podium, every time somebody walked up, it said, God's in charge. And so every time that somebody walked up and said, you know, oh, I'm having trouble with this, I said, God's in charge. And I said, and by the way, are you having any fun? Because our committee meeting was fun. We had a good time. That's part of what I learned in Al-Anon. It's okay. Even on a bad day, it's okay to have fun. It really is. It really is. And it's okay to have humor in your life, even if things aren't going the way you want them to. Things don't go the way I want to frequently. Doesn't mean I can't still have a good attitude. I can pick my attitude on a daily basis the same way as I go in my closet and pick out my clothes. It's a choice. I can have that choice. I was taught by a Catholic priest, and I went to talk to him about my divorce, and he said, well, it seems like you've kind of worked through that, because I had. I'd worked my program through it, so he noticed that. I said, I have. And so I thought, you know, when he gave me my penance for being such a naughty little Catholic girl, that I'd probably have to go out and kneel in the middle of the main street and say 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys, right? But no, what he told me was, I want you to go out all day tomorrow, and I want you to be happy all day. Well, that was the first time in my life I ever knew I had a choice. Because that next day, every time I wasn't happy, I'd say, oh, wait a minute, this is my penance. Gotta be happy. So do you think that priest knew what he was talking to when he was talking to me? He knew what he was talking to. But I always remember that being that's the first time I was aware that I have a total choice on whether I'm happy or not. It's not easy, but it's simple. Our whole program, nothing in this program works easy, but it's all very simple, particularly if you take your sponsor's direction. Little pitch for sponsors. I do sponsor in this program. I have a sponsor, I sponsor people, and to me it's like a little chain. And that was another area that helped me grow, was sponsoring women who would come to me and tell me the trouble they were having, pour their hearts out. And I could sit there and say, uh-huh. Wait till I tell you what I did. And they looked at me and go, you didn't ever do anything, did you? And I go, mm-hmm. So that reminds me, you know, when I'm talking to sponsees, almost always, sometime during that day or the next day, I'm going to need what it is that I've said to them. It just works like that. It always works like that. My sponsor is, let's see, about as tough as a corn cob, and I don't like her. She's always telling me these things that I don't want to do. You know, her favorite thing to me, when I call her and tell her all these awful things that people are doing to me, and these awful things that she goes, "What's your part in it?" I hate that. I hate that. But seriously, she is my sponsor because she has what I want. She's warm, loving, giving, kind, gentle, tolerant, all the things that I want to be one of these days if I keep coming. Going on with working the steps, you know, once I did find out, you know, what my defects of character were, you know, doing 6 and 7, then, you know, 8 and 9 taught me, now I have to go make amends for that stuff. And I remember making that list saying, okay, well, I can make amends to a couple of people up here and maybe a couple here, but there was a whole bunch at the bottom that I was never going to make amends to. But, you know, as God would have it, after I made the first couple, then the middle ones got easier. And by the time I got the middle ones done and I started getting down to those bottom ones that were never, I was able to do those also. The person I had probably more anger and resentment against in my life was my brother. I think he's the one I wrote my resentments. I think he was the very first one I wrote about. I really thought that I hated him. I felt so abused by him all my life. He tried at one point to even sexually abuse me. He didn't succeed, but because I think at that point I was bigger than him. But anyway, it was a very, very difficult relationship my whole life. So when I got to the point where I need to make amends to him, I couldn't figure out what my part in it was. Until one day I read in One Day at a Time that I don't need to forgive you if I haven't judged you in the first place. And so what I realized was I had judged him all of his life. I remember people telling me, he stayed in Illinois for a lot of years after I came to California, and I would go back to visit, and they'd say, "Oh, your brother, oh, he's so wonderful." And I'd say, "Really? Tell me about that." And they'd say, "Oh, don't you know what he does? He does this and he does that." I said, "Oh, no, I didn't know that. Thanks for telling me." I didn't believe it, and it didn't change anything. But coming to Al-Anon did. Coming to Al-Anon made me realize that I was only hurting myself by holding on to that resentment against him. So one day, he by now had moved to California also, and he was living in San Bernardino, and his daughter was coming to visit him. And he called me, and he said, "Helen, I'd love it if your daughter and my daughter and I could all get together for lunch." And so I said to him, "Well, that'd be okay, because I'd done my writing. I hadn't quite forgiven him, but I'd done my writing." And we did. We went to lunch, and we had a wonderful time. And he told me, as he was leaving, that he really liked what I had become. Of course, he has no program, so he had to finish it off. "I hope you stay that way." Within about, I don't know, days, I don't know if it was a week, 10 days, I know it wasn't very many days, he died. So it's really difficult to make amends to people after they die. So I was so grateful that that happened, that my slate was clean. And I never said anything to him, I just changed. And that happened with my children too, because what are you going to do with children, you know, that are in their 20s by the time I got to Al-Anon, and all the damage I had done to them over all those years? How could I possibly make amends for that? So my amends to my children were, I changed. And if ever they would say to me, "Well, you used to you know, all that stuff they give you, right?" I'd say to them, "Do I do that now?" And they'd say, "Sometimes." And I say, "Okay, I give you permission. If I do it sometimes still, would you tell me? Would you tell me when I'm doing it?" Oh, I didn't like it when they told me. But since I'd given them permission, then I had to say, "Well, thank you. And I will look at that, and I will work on not doing it any longer." I have an absolutely amazing relationship with both of those daughters. Amazing. They are both sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea I was living with three alcoholics again. That's what I grew up with, all those alcoholics, and I had three more. I had no idea. I was so focused on my husband and his disease and his bad behavior and all the other stuff that he did. I had no idea that I had two alcoholic daughters in my home. One of them came home after I'd been in Al-Anon for a couple of years and told me that she had 60 days of sobriety in AA. And I said to her, "Why? And she said, because I'm an alcoholic. And I go, no, you're not. Your father's an alcoholic. But indeed she was. And I know she is because I've listened to her speak off the pulpit. So I know she, or the podium, the pulpit, God, I'm back in church. The podium. Sorry, I forgot to shift gears. And then my second daughter pulled the same thing on me, came home and told me she had 60 days of sobriety, and guess what I said to her? Why? You know, they're both these, you know, beautiful, achieving everything, the it girls, you know, and they're both alcoholics, and that was like beyond my imagining. My oldest daughter has maintained her sobriety. She had a birthday a little bit ago. I can't remember exactly when. I do know because it's on my calendar. And she has 27 years. My younger daughter had 25, and she had a slip at 25 years. But you know, I have so much program, and I have so much people around me, and I have so much understanding, and I have so much love that whether the alcoholic drinks or not, it doesn't have to affect me, that it didn't affect me. She called me only after she was back in program and told me that she had a slip and she was back in program. And the only thing I said to her was, honey, I'm just so happy. I'm so happy that you found your way back. Was it hard? And she said, I could not believe how quickly I went back to the way I was. But the good news is she's back. And we have sobriety in our family. I have a son-in-law that a lot of you guys in here know, Bob G. He came to the Covina meetings for lots of years, and then they moved to Carlsbad. So some of you may not know him any longer, but a great member of Al-Anon. He and I are buddies. My daughter calls me and says, do you understand what Bob is doing? I don't understand what he's doing. And I go, yes, I do. Let me tell you. And she goes, oh, my God, I married my mother. I said, yes, you did. Sorry to say. So what it's like today, as you can hear, is it's a wonderful life. The program gives to me exactly what I give to it. I get out of it exactly what I put into it. And on the days when I'm willing to do everything that I'm supposed to do, I was taught to get on my knees every morning. I do the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer from the Big Book of AA every morning. It talks about being grateful. It talks about, whatever I am today, I offer it up to God. Be the best I can. I'm not perfect. Well, I was when I got here, but I'm not anymore. And I do make mistakes. And you know what I allow myself to do? I allow myself to make one mistake a day. And I don't beat myself up for that. If I made two a day, oh, that wouldn't be pretty. No. But one a day is okay. And so many times I have to tell myself that because I still have that need to look good and I still have that need to be perfect. And when I make a mistake, it's still hard. But then I just remember, it's okay. And hardly anybody cares anyway. I care more than anybody else that I've made a mistake. And I'm harder on me than anybody else. When I made amends, I had to be up there on top because nobody treated me as badly as I treated myself. So if you're new tonight, I know there's a few of you that are, please, this program works. I came here really broken, really confused, really angry, sad. And I just put myself in the chair. And nobody told me that I had to do anything. Nobody said, you have to work the steps, dear. You've been coming too long now. You're not working. Nobody told me that. They just said, keep coming back. We already love you in a special way. So please do that. Grab a hold of somebody and talk to them tonight. And I think this meeting has a phone list. Take a phone list with you. But most of all, keep coming back. I like to end when I speak with a little thing that I learned off of someone else's talk. I borrowed it. Now it's mine. And I actually end my prayers in the morning kind of with the same sort of thing. Thank you, God, for all that you've given me. Thank you for all you've taken from me. Thank you for all that you've left me. And I wish you all peace and joy. And I learned a description of joy recently, and it goes like this. Perfect acquiescence, acceptance, and rest in God's will, whatever comes. Thanks for having me.